So chapter 9, text 3, Ashadhadana Purusha Dharmasyasya Parantapa Aprapyamam Nivartante Mrityu Samsara Vartmani. Those who are not faithful in this devotional service cannot attain me, O conqueror of enemies. Therefore they return to the path of birth and death in the material world. Prabhupada says here, the faithless cannot accomplish this process of devotional service. That is the purport of this verse. Faith is created by association with devotees. Okay? So now let's just kind of put this in context. We spent pretty much all class yesterday talking about the second verse of the ninth chapter. Rajavidya-rajaguyam pavitramanum uttamam. So Rajavidya, what does that refer to? What does Prabhupada indicate it refers to in the purport? Anyone remember? Yes, that's what it means, but
it's knowledge that distinguishes activity on the bodily platform and activity on the spiritual platform.
Okay, that's true. It's true. Thank you. Anything else? Remember we talked about the Sad Darshan?
The night activities?
No. Anyone? Bueller? No? Okay, so some faces looking downward as if immersed in study, yet actually thinking, don't call on me, don't call on me. Huh? Remember we talked about the Sad Darshan, we talked about Karma Mimamsa and Nyaya, we talked about Ashtanga Yoga, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, yeah? And we talked about Vedanta. So Vedanta means the end of all knowledge. Prabhupada mentions this in the purport. So of all these different systems of philosophy, the Rajavidya that Krishna is describing in this chapter, which is the most confidential part of knowledge, the highest level of knowledge, knowledge of Bhagavan, right, the personality of Godhead, it is actually, you know, Vedanta. It's the end of all knowledge. And also, you know, we kind of talked about that in great detail. It's interesting because also in the 15th chapter, Krishna mentions that he is Vedanta Krit Veda Vidya Eva Chaham, right? He is the compiler of Vedanta. He is Vyasadeva himself. Vyasadeva is the leader or the progenitor of the Vedanta school. Yeah, and who's in the Vedanta school? What groups?
The Vaishnavas.
Yes, the Vaishnavas.
Followers of Shankaracharya.
Yes, and the Mayavadis, yeah. So there's the four Vaishnava Sampradayas, including our own, are within the Vedanta school. And we talked about, in the Srimad Bhagavatam is the natural commentary by Srila Vyasadeva on the Vedanta Sutra itself. Yeah, and so really, when Krishna's talking about the Rajavidya, he's talking about Vedanta, and to be even more clear, he's talking about Bhakti Yoga. He's talking about worship of him, right? He's at the very center of Rajavidya. Rajavidya means knowledge of himself. Yeah? And therefore, Ashradadana Purusha, as it says here, you have to be faithful. What else do you have to be? As mentioned in the first verse?
Non-envious.
Yes, Anasuyave, right? You have to be. So here we see Krishna is essentially saying, you know, here I'm going to present the highest form of knowledge. I'm going to present the Rajavidya. Yeah? Remember we talked yesterday, Manmana Bhavamad Bhakta Madhyabjimam Namaskadu. The essence of this chapter, or rather the culmination of this chapter, is the very end when Krishna describes, you know, just put your mind upon me, surrender to me, become my devotee, pay obeisances unto me. Yeah? Engage in a relationship with me through devotional service. So this is the highest form of knowledge. Now, there are certain qualifications you need to approach that. You have to be Ashradhadana, as mentioned here. I'm sorry, you have to be Shraddhadana. You know, you have to have Shraddha. And you have to be Anasuyave. You have to be non-envious, okay? So when you're approaching the personality of Godhead, you know, there's certain requirements. You essentially have to be non-envious. You have to be approaching with the right attitude. You have to be approaching with humility, the desire to do service, without envy towards Krishna. You have to essentially be approaching in surrender. Otherwise, he's not interested, right? So if you want to come towards this supreme absolute level of knowledge, you have to approach with the right attitude. And as Krishna continues today, Ashradhana Purusha, if you don't have faith, then what's going to happen to you? You can never take to this. Aprapyamam nivartante. You can never attain me, right? You can never approach me. Nivartante, you fall down. mrityu samsara vartmani, into the path of birth and death. Or, you know, rather, mrityu and samsara, into the path of death and the cycle of rebirth. So, you know, if you essentially, because remember, look at this all in the context of what we've been discussing. In the last chapter, the eighth chapter, it was all about surrendering to Krishna and overcoming the cycle of birth and death, right? Mm-hmm. You surrender unto him, you think of him at the time of death, and you go to him. And he protects you, he takes control. And so that's part of this whole process of surrender to him. And so if you don't, then you will not receive freedom from the cycle of birth and death. And so you have to have Shraddha. And as Prabhupada mentions here, the faithless cannot accomplish this process of devotional service. That is the purport of this verse. So if you're Ashraddhana, if you don't have faith, you're not going to go very far in devotional service. In fact, Prabhupada mentions here, faith is created by association with devotees. So if you remember in the Nectar Devotion, there's the whole beginning of devotional service with Shraddha. Then it goes Saru Sangha, Bhajana Kriya, Nartana Vritti, Nishna, Ruchi, Asakta, Bhava, Prema. Right? Those are the nine different stages of devotional service. And so throughout that, the basic foundation of it all is faith. And what is faith? Sarva dharmam prityajam mam ekam sharanam braja. That if I just surrender to Krishna, that's all I really need. Sarva karma kritahaya, right? If I just surrender to Krishna, he'll protect me, and all dharma, all activities, anything I could ever want or need is there within Krishna. Essentially, he'll protect me and give me whatever I could desire, whatever I could want in life, all happiness, all satisfaction, all beauty, all knowledge, all wealth, all strength, all fame. All of this is within Krishna. All I have to do is surrender unto him, and I can trust him. Like we mentioned before, you go to Christian camp or something. You ever go to Christian camp?
No.
So when you're in Christian camp, and I never went either, but I had lots of friends who went to did this sort of stuff. So they usually have this, you know, practice where you stand up on a ladder or a table, something. You get up real high, 6 feet high, and there's all your friends. They all stand around beneath you, and you're supposed to close your eyes and fall back, you know, and your friends are supposed to catch you, hopefully. Right? It is Christian camp, so you should be able to trust them, right? So, but you're having faith that they'll protect you, and that's kind of what they're trying to demonstrate. You know, you have to have faith in Jesus, right? Which you do, especially if you're a Christian. You have to have this faith. And it's not so much blind faith, like you have to somehow close your eyes, you know, like, for example, in those particular, I don't know what you'd call that, demonstrations. You know, usually they put a blindfold around their eyes or something. But it's not blind faith. It's the kind of faith that it's almost like, imagine if you look down at your friends who are supposed to catch you, and you can't see them because there's a fog, and you have to kind of fall through the fog, right? Now, the more purified you become, that fog dissolves, and you're able to see your friend more and more. Yeah? So it's the same thing with Krishna. You know, in the beginning, you may be blindfolded in the sense that you don't have any pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam. There's no direct perception, right? Remember we talked about that yesterday too? So at a certain stage, you develop direct perception. You're able to see through the fog. You're able to see Krishna directly there. And then it's not a blind faith. You just jump in. Hey, you know, Nityagaur, right? Crowd surfing or something. Jump on Krishna. You know, you jump into his arms because you see that he's there, right? So that, but in the beginning, there is a sense in which, you know, because of ignorance and material conditioning, you really don't see Krishna. And therefore, there's an element of trying to trust Krishna and having faith that he's there behind your fog, right? Behind your own ignorance. And so, you know, this is one of the main things which is a obstacle to our devotional services when we don't have that faith. Yeah, we have a hridayo balyam, you know, we have a weakness of heart. We don't have faith in God, and therefore we're very slow. That's why we drag our feet, right? Why is it that we move so slowly? Why is it that we're not 100% Krishna conscious or 100% God conscious? Because we don't really have full faith. We're kind of trying to protect ourselves, you know? Rather than just jump and fall into Krishna's arms, we're like, well, maybe I'll kind of put my toe down into the fog and, you know, I'll try to go little by little down there, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of fog right there, and maybe just I'll stretch my body. Maybe I'll kind of climb down a little halfway, see if I can't feel. Is there anything down there? I don't feel anything. Maybe I'll go a little slower, right? So, you know, especially when it comes to sense gratification and happiness, you know, we try to hold some for ourselves because we're not really sure that we'll be happy from Krishna. right? Like the reason that we go slowly is because we're attached to sense gratification. The reason we're attached to sense gratification is because of a lack of faith. We don't think that we'll be happy from Krishna. We think that, you know, I have to, you know, also have my world of sense gratification, otherwise I won't be happy. If I just jump down altogether and give it all to Krishna, who knows what's going to happen? You know, I could be miserable. Could end up one of these miserable devotees, right? And look at all these miserable Vaishnavas, you know, they made the mistake of jumping to Krishna, you know, and there's nothing there. They just splattered, right? So this that's also the way we look at Vaishnavas and look at the devotees, look at Krishna consciousness, right? We don't have a lot of faith. We tend to project, you know, our fears, you know, onto people. So this is really what makes us go slow, is a lack of Shraddha. Okay? And so this whole process of moving upwards from Shraddha to Sadhu Sangha to Bhajana Kriya, it's all by the association of devotees, especially advanced devotees. Like we have Srila Prabhupada, or even, you know, we have our gurus, right? And so these different devotees, their association is actually what's lifting us up. In fact, it begins with association, right? When you first enter into Shraddha, it's because someone engaged you in Krishna service. It's called, Agyata Sukriti. So you don't know that this devotee is engaging you in devotional service. Somehow or other, you had contact with Krishna, you heard the Maha Mantra, or you contacted the Shastra. And so somehow or other, you've been introduced to Krishna service. You didn't even know what it was. But because you did Krishna service, now you're going to be attracted to Krishna service. Right? And next time you come across it, you're going to do more. And then because you've done more, you're going to be more attracted. And so you'll, next time you come across it, you'll do more, right? And it keeps growing and growing and growing until you're ready to associate with devotees, until you're mature. Your faith gradually matures so that you, you know, till you get to the point where you're 100% throwing yourself to Krishna. That's like in bhava and prema, right? Where you have 100% faith in Krishna and the fog is gone. You have total realization of Krishna. That's why you, it's not that, you know, a maturation of faith means you're ready to just jump into the fog. No, the fog vanishes, right? That's when you have absolute faith, when you can look down and see all your friends, right? And you're not blindfolded and you know they're going to catch you. You just jump right into them. There's no fear at all. So as Krishna says, Mashuchaha, do not fear. And so it's a process of developing full faith. Does that make sense? So this Ashradadana Purusha, there's the Krishna knows, he's the super soul. He knows why people don't surrender, right? He knows what the problem is. He knows why we drag our feet, you know, because it's a lack of faith. And so for them, for people who have zero faith, they have no faith, then you stay caught in the cycle of birth and death. You're not going to be able to attain him. So the development of faith is of paramount importance, not only in our relationship with Krishna, but in our desire for liberation. Okay? Yeah?
So it says here, unfortunate people, even after hearing all the evidence of Vedic literature from great personalities, still have no faith in God. They are hesitant and cannot stay fixed in devotional service to the Lord. So, does this mean that they're just not getting the association of devotees? Or what? Can you...
Is
there a qualification that's mentioned in the seventh chapter, like the four people that don't approach Krishna?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, unfortunate people. In other words, I think it's correct what you're saying when you're mentioning the four fortunate people. But you have the four unfortunate, the Naradama, right, as one of them. Yeah. And so the Naradama is someone who knows, you know, he has the higher culture. Well, there's a couple different interpretations, you know, Prabhupada gives in different places. But Naradama in one sense means, at least Prabhupada mentions there, you know, human beings who do not have the principles of religion and culture, etc. But another is that an individual who knows the Dharma and understands the highest truth but just rejects it. You know, just kind of like, nah, it's okay, I understand what religion is and I understand what I'm supposed to do, but I don't really care. Right, and that's really a fallen person. That's what Naradama means. And so for such people, then you never get to the stage of being fixed. When Prabhupada says you cannot stay fixed in devotional service, I would say this refers to nishta, you know, which is there's the stage of devotional service we should all be striving for. Right? It means like you have to come to the level where you are basically steady in your absorption in Krishna. Your faith has to get that strong. But unfortunately, you know, there's a stage where if we're doubting, if we have this quality of ashradadhana, then even though we hear and even though we may do devotional service, still we'll fall away, right? And so generally that happens because you haven't gone through an Artha Nivritti, you know? Like there's many different reasons people may fall away from Krishna consciousness, but essentially you're overwhelmed by your anarthas, like your faith isn't strong enough to get you through kind of the more difficult lower stages of devotional service. That's what I would say. Okay?
Can that be due to like improper association, like not associating with advanced devotees, not making, you know, like an effort on our part to try to associate with advanced devotees? Because we don't make that effort, our faith gradually diminishes when our anarthas are kind of overwhelming us and it's kind of harder.
I mean, there's so many reasons, you know, but the primary reason is offenses. Right? You make offenses to the deities, offenses to the devotees, offenses to the holy name, and then, you know, very quickly you'll be overwhelmed. But I think what Prabhupada's mentioning here is that persons that hear about Krishna and still have no faith. Like, in other words, this is like a very low, I think what Prabhupada's describing here in the purport is kind of a very low level, in that you have an individual who, even though you have good association, you still don't have the faith to really even stay in the process at all, right? You know, and you may, as I think what you're talking about is more like devotees that have been around for a while, you know, and have sincerely committed to the process but are falling away to various different reasons. So generally you'll see with that you're dealing with offenses, right? But I think the point Prabhupada's making here in that sentence you read is that you have, you can still, like, faith is such an important part of this whole process that it's kind of like even good association depends on it. Like there can be an individual who has the association devotees and still is not able to take advantage of it due to a lack of faith. Like their faith is not mature. So I think Prabhupada's kind of qualifying what he said in the previous sentence that faith comes by the mercy of the devotees. You know, they engage you in the whole process and they start you going. And it's by their favoritism, their mercy, that you stay within the process, really. Especially your spiritual master. And yet, you can be so faithless that even while having that mercy, you can't take advantage of it. Okay? Now, you know, for those devotees that are really kind of pushing forward in devotional service and fall away, you know, you can also say that's also a lack of faith on a certain level. But usually it's because of some actions you've done, some words you've spoken, right? Something you've done to give offense, especially to devotees. Okay. Otherwise, yeah, Prabhupada says here, thus faith is a most important factor for progress in Krishna consciousness. So, you know, this is a very profound thing. We have to have this faith in Krishna. And, I mean, since we mentioned it, it's kind of like if you make offenses to devotees, Krishna more or less withdraws his mercy to you. And so there's a sense in which your Krishna consciousness and your faith in Krishna is really dependent upon his mercy, you know, at all stages. And that mercy, as said, also comes through the devotees. But really, this is a kind of mercy that's upon you. And you're developing it, you know, you're cultivating it. And if you make offenses, then very quickly that mercy can be withdrawn and your faith, your bhakti lata bija, like, crumples under the heat, you know, of your offense. So it's a very dangerous thing. Prabhupada mentions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it is said that faith in is the complete conviction that by simply serving the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, one can achieve all perfection. So that's what I quoted before, the Sarva Karma Kritahaya. Right? That is called real faith. As stated in the Shrimad Bhagavatam 4:31-14, Yatat toror mula nishchananena tripyanti tatskandha bujopashakaha pranoparachcha yatendriyanam tataiva sarvar hanam achuteja. By giving water to the root of a tree, one satisfies its branches, twigs, and leaves. And by supplying food to the stomach, one satisfies all the senses of the body. Simply by engaging in the transcendental service of the Supreme Lord, one automatically satisfies all the demigods and all other living entities. So this is an example of faith, you know, that if I just serve Krishna, then all perfection is there. I don't have to serve any demigods or anything like that. I don't have to serve, you know, humanity on a mundane level. All I have to do is serve Krishna, and that's my life is perfect, right? And like translate that into our modern way of thinking. It's kind of like, look, I don't have to worry, don't have to fear. I can just serve Krishna and surrender to Krishna, give myself to Krishna. I'm not going to miss out on anything. He'll take care of me. Right? This is really at the pit of our hesitation. Yeah, the pit, meaning like the pit of our stomach, you know, is at the core of our hesitation is, you know, I don't know, you know, what's going to happen to me, right? If I just surrender fully to Krishna, what the heck's going to happen to me? Am I going to be living in a dumpster and, you know, in Skid Row or something, right? Or is Krishna really going to screw me over? Excuse my language, I shouldn't say that, but you know what I mean? Like, is Krishna going to somehow just leave me hanging, right? This is our fear. Remember, Arjuna even asked about that, I think in the sixth chapter, right? What's the destination for the yoga brashta, the fallen yogi? You know, I don't know. You know, what's going to happen to me if I try to surrender to Krishna? Is he really going to take care of me? Can I really trust him with that? Can I trust Krishna with me and my life? I don't know. You know, we better protect number one, right? I got to put number one first, and then, you know, once I get everything steady and stable in my life, then I'll try to surrender to Krishna, right? Of course, you never do get to that stage. So as it's saying here, therefore, after reading Bhagavad Gita, one should promptly come to the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. One should give up all of the engagements and adopt the service of the Supreme Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead. If one is convinced of this philosophy of life, that is faith. So that's the Sarva Dharmam Parityaja, Mamekam Sharanam Raja Aham Tam Sarva Papebhyo Mokshayishami Mahashuchaha. So Krishna is saying, do not fear, you know, I'll rescue you, I'll save you from all sinful reactions. I will catch you, right? I will catch you. You don't have to worry. Don't fear, just surrender. Just give yourself to me. Have full faith in me. Okay? So, let's take a look at... this kind of elaborates more on your question, Davis. If we look about halfway through the next paragraph, Prabhupada says, as far as the development of faith is concerned, one who is well-versed in the literatures of devotional service and has attained the stage of firm faith is called a first-class person in Krishna consciousness. So this is the Uttamadhikari, right? We hear about this in Nectar Instruction especially. There's different qualifications given in the Chaitanya Charitamrita in the 11th canto describing the different characteristics of the Uttama, Madhyama, and Kanishtha, right? And so the Uttama Adhikari, he has full faith in the literatures. He's well-versed, and he has like the highest level of faith. Basically, he has this pratyaksha vagamam dharmyam. He's directly seeing the personality of Godhead. And for him, there's no doubt. You know, just like we said before, like with Plato's cave analogy, you know, say you have some people trapped in a cave. Well, if somebody who's been outside looking at the sun goes into the cave and says, hey, come outside, there's a sun. And he describes the sun and everything. I don't know if I can believe the sun. You know, and he's like, no, it's there. Trust me, you know, I've seen it with my own eyes. I don't know if I can have faith in you, right? But the person who's telling him, it's not like he goes, well, geez, maybe these guys are right. Maybe there is no sun. It's like, no, he's directly seen it. In fact, he can go to the mouth of the cave and look right at the sun and talk to them at the same time, right? He's directly looking at the sun. There's no question that it doesn't exist. So for that individual, he's an Uttamadhikari. He has a very strong faith, and when he speaks, he can convince anyone. It's very hard to argue with such a person when so they're looking right at the sun and you're trying to convince them there is no sun. You're going to find it a little bit difficult, right? you can express all your doubts and everything like that, and they can clear them up because it's like it's clear and present right before them, the truth. And therefore, they're very expert at explaining it. Not only that, but they can explain it through the Shastra. They'll depend upon the authority of Scripture. And they're very well versed within the Scripture. And Prabhupada says here, in the second class, there are those who are not very advanced in understanding the devotional scriptures, but who automatically have firm faith in Krishna bhakti, or service to Krishna, is the best course, and so in good faith have taken it up. So the Madhyamadhikari, he may not be so strong in his understanding of scripture. You know, he knows some shlokas and stuff, right? Knows some shlokas. But he's primarily just got faith. You know, he believes very strongly. And Prabhupada here says that it's the best course in life, right? The best course is to surrender to Krishna. He may not even have direct realization, you know, on the level of the Uttamadhikari, but he really does believe that, you know, I can surrender to Krishna and I'll be safe, right? And so, you know, he He may not be perfect. He may be struggling and everything like that. But he's basically pushing forward with all his might. Dhritavrata, he has a very strong determination no matter what. He's going to keep pushing forward and try to surrender to Krishna. Okay, that's a Madhyama Adhikari. And therefore, it's also a little bit difficult to defeat a Madhyama Adhikari in debate. Unless, you know, you may even defeat him scripturally or something. But it's going to be hard to, like, convert him to your particular faith. That's when two people have two opposing faiths. Basically, they come together, and whoever has the stronger faith generally can bend the other towards his will. You know, like a Christian with strong faith or something. You know, then it's, you know, maybe you have very weak faith. You know, they'll have you guessing, right? Even if they could or could not defeat you scripturally or anything like that, or even logically, still, you know, they're a little bit shooken up afterwards. Or you may shake them up, right? You know, like they come at you, you know, Jesus is the only way, you know, you're going to hell. Something. You know, not all Christians speak like that, of course, but sometimes you'll get some radical, you know, extremists that'll come up to you, and if they see you're dressed like a devotee, then certainly they'll come after you. And so, you know, but oftentimes you may have stronger faith than them, you know, and then they walk away, you know, and they feel like a little shaken and stuff. Like, I can't believe, you know, this person, right, has such faith, you know what I mean? So, you know, a Madhyama Adhikari has that kind of, that strength of determination to surrender where their faith is not malleable. It can't really be pushed around or shaped by someone else's faith. Okay? Whereas the Kanishtha Adhikari, it says here, let's just continue. It says, thus they are superior to the third class who have neither perfect knowledge of the scriptures nor good faith, but by association and simplicity are trying to follow. So the Kanishtha doesn't really understand the scriptures very well. You know, this is like your new bhakta, no offense. So it doesn't understand the scriptures very well and also has very weak faith. And so, you know, the faith is very malleable. It's komala shraddha, right? It's a very soft, like silly putty. You ever play with silly putty? Right, you push your finger into it and it takes the shape, or clay, soft clay, you know. However you put your hand in it, you can shape it. Therefore you'll see, you know, you can even see yourself. Maybe when you're a new bhakta or something, then you are, you know, having all sorts of doubts. I remember I used to like go read different philosophies and stuff secretly. Secretly read different philosophies because maybe they're right, you know, I don't know. Right? Or, you know, you have kind of, and I'm not saying like Krishna consciousness is the right philosophy in a kind of close-minded sort of narrow ideological view, but rather it's a very broad perspective into which other ideologies can easily fit, you know? Like if you, in other words, in the mind of the neophyte, oftentimes you're in a world of warring ideologies that are, you know, each is narrow and each is attacking the other. That's not what we're talking about, right? When, as you become more mature in your faith, whatever your ideology may be, even if you're a Christian, you're a Hindu, whatever, then your perspective, and especially through practice and experience and purification, your perspective will broaden to where you no longer see other ideologies as a threat. Rather, you even see them complementary to your own. You know, like if you have a mature Vaishnava meets, you know, a mature Christian or even a non-mature Christian or something, it doesn't feel threatened at all. Or actually, he sees this person serving the Supreme Lord. It's wonderful. You know, and even if that person has a very narrow perspective that, you know, you're doing it wrong or you're worshiping the devil or whatever, you know, they don't take that part of it. You know, it's like, I see the worship of God going on. It's a very beautiful thing. And yes, there's this kind of misunderstanding, but it's not so important. I don't really, right? But they have like a real broad perspective, which is more or less, you know, accepting of other people's worship and appreciative. And it strengthens their own faith to see people of other religions worshiping God, you know, in the proper way. So that, you know, it's a very sort of broad and tolerant perspective. So once you develop that sort of perspective to where you can see in reality, you know, God everywhere and ultimately understand sort of how he's expanded and extended himself to different people at different times and places with messages they can understand, then you're not threatened by other people's faiths. Does that make sense? But when you're, you know, sort of young, no matter what your particular religion is, then there's a tendency towards extremism. Yeah? Because you have weak faith, because you have this kind of soft, malleable faith, you have to defend it, you know, like aggressively or like antagonistically, right? I mean, if you see somebody's very, very fanatical about pushing their particular religious ideology in an aggressive, domineering, and offensive way, it generally indicates they're not very fixed in their own faith, right? They're sort of overcompensating for a lack of true faith. Mm. They're imitating what they think it would look like if somebody had a lot of faith, right? You know, and therefore you get, you know, religious violence or religious conflict, yeah? Nor are they very knowledgeable in the scriptures. So you'll find, you know, sometimes these people that are the most extremist or most violent or competitive or aggressive and narrow-minded, they're actually also the ones who understand their scriptures the least, right? Or even are at least, you know, they may memorize their verses or something. They may thump their particular scripture and memorize all these verses, but they don't really have a very deep philosophical tradition, or they don't have a deep nuanced opinion about things, you know? Like you see in certain religious groups, like for example, I've just given an example, like in Catholicism, you know, there's a very deep, rich tradition of philosophy that goes back, you know, thousands of years, and they've been discussing it and developing their perspective, and it's very nuanced, and, you know, if you're truly representing the Catholic Church, then you're going to give a very intelligent, sort of wise, mature perspective on Scripture, right? It's not going to be some kind of narrow, fanatical, like whatever you think, that's what it is. Right? There's like a standard that's there, a standard interpretation. Whereas if you get some kind of like, you know, super, you know, whatever, super...
Super Jesus Church.
Yeah, yeah, they're just extremely, you know, like aggressive and everything like that. Yeah, they may memorize the words and stuff like that, but there's not like a deep philosophical tradition behind it. You know, it's not very well thought out. Sometimes it can be very aggressive, so... Anyway, when you have like a person who has weak faith, also, as it says here, they're basically, it's very easy for someone to fall down, right? You very easily give up your practice, which is kind of what you're asking about. You know, like when people may know and understand, but ultimately there's a level of ashradadana, purusha, right? As described in this verse. So, in other words, the neophyte is also ashradadana to a certain extent, yeah? His faith is weak, and therefore there's the propensity to fall down, and again fall down into the cycle of birth and death, to fall away from the path of yoga. Okay? Any questions about that? Let's continue to go ahead on this, because it's kind of important. Third-class person in Krishna consciousness may fall down, but when one is in the second class, he does not fall down. And for the first class person in Krishna consciousness, there's no chance of falling down. One in the first class will surely make progress and achieve the result at the end. As far as the third class person in Krishna consciousness is concerned, although he has faith in the conviction that devotional service to Krishna is very good, he has not yet gained adequate knowledge of Krishna through the scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Okay, so there's a need for knowledge. Yeah, there's a need for a deep philosophical understanding based upon scripture. You have to have your worldview has to be in order, right? Like you have to be able to see your intelligence, in a sense, has to be purified by Shastra so that you can see things clearly as they are from the perspective of the Shastra, you know? And generally speaking, the less you know of Shastra, you know, the weaker your faith will be. If you don't really know what the situation is, then you're going to make some serious mistakes, right? And you'll see a lot of difficulties that a neophyte may have are precisely because of this. And usually they'll manifest as something like, it doesn't always come out as like some kind of philosophical misunderstanding, which is kind of what we may think of right here, but rather just a misunderstanding in perspective or a lack of maturity in perspective. Like you may see a devotee is not perfect in their Krishna consciousness or something. So then it's very typical of a neophyte if they see somebody is like, weak in their devotional service, it breaks their own faith, right? Like they can't handle it. They feel like, oh, you know, the Krishna consciousness doesn't work, or, you know, there's... like if you see one little problem, then immediately your whole worldview goes spinning out of control because you don't really understand what's going on. Like you don't really see the picture, the picture of reality through the scriptures. You don't have a deep enough perspective on who that devotee is, what their problem is, or what the issue is, how to see it. Right? What's the proper way to see it? You don't have the proper understanding of Vaishnava etiquette, right? How to interact with senior, junior, and equal. Like there's a whole perspective that you have to kind of cast out onto the world, and that gives you maturity to deal with the different things that you'll interact with. Right? So it's not just a question of like, you know, the neophyte doesn't know enough shlokas. You know, it's rather, it's the neophyte doesn't have a clear picture of reality through the shastra. And therefore, when they come across different issues, they're bewildered by that. And they become, you know, disturbed in their faith. They lose their faith very easily. You know, oh my gosh, you know, I saw this devotee. You know, he's, you know, I've been a devotee for 2 months. I saw this devotee. He's been a devotee for 8 months, if you can imagine. And I saw him smoking a cigarette right across the street on top of the car parking garage, right? I went up there to chant japa and I saw him smoking a cigarette. Oh my God, that's it. Krishna consciousness doesn't work. You know, it's all going to fail. You know, and so there's so many ways that, you know, so many different things that one could see or experience. And you'll see among neophytes then there's a lot of criticism, right? Neophytes are kanishtas, they're prakriti, right? They're absorbed in prakriti, they're absorbed in the material, but they don't have the philosophical basis by which to understand the material in devotional service, right? Like, say, for example, like when you see different devotees' faults, you're looking at the material. You're not looking at the spirit soul, right? You're not looking at their devotion to Krishna. Or you see faults in a community or in a temple or whatever, in a church, in a particular religion, when you're looking at faults, essentially what you're looking at is the material conditioning. Yeah? You're looking at the material side of things. And so the kanishta is always absorbed in the material side of things. But the kanishta doesn't have the maturity to see the material side of things from a clear scriptural perspective. And therefore the neophyte will criticize and criticize and criticize and find fault and find fault. Right? That's what new bhaktas secretly do. Yeah? You get to get, you know, like you just kind of find some little mistake or little fault and then absorb in it and really blow it out of proportion. And you blow it out of proportion because you don't have proportion. You don't have a philosophical system and perspective from which to see things in a balanced and structured way. So even the slightest little thing blows apart your kind of very simplistic worldview of what is devotional service. And how it relates to, you know, the individual and the struggle for purification. Does that make sense? I'm talking about this because this situation has arisen. Right? So we have to really think about this and understand this, that these things arise from the neophyte perspective on things. And essentially, the neophyte is struggling with faith. And that's really what it is. Okay? All right. Prabhupada says here, sometimes these third-class persons in Krishna consciousness have some tendency towards karma yoga and jnana yoga, and sometimes they're disturbed, but as soon as the infection of karma yoga or jnana yoga is vanquished, they become second-class or first-class persons in Krishna consciousness. So, you know, there's a tendency to be attracted to other practices outside devotional service, or, you know, full surrender to the Supreme Lord, because you don't really have faith, you know, in Krishna. You want to bolster your spiritual practice with things which you have more faith in. Yeah. So faith in Krishna is also divided into three stages and described in Srimad Bhagavatam. First class attachment, second class attachment, and third class attachment. Also explained in Srimad Bhagavatam in the 11th canto. Those who have no faith, even after hearing about Krishna and the excellence of devotional service, who think that it is simply eulogy, find the path very difficult. Even if they are supposedly engaged in devotional service, for them there is very little hope of gaining perfection. Thus, faith is very important in the discharge of devotional service. So you think it's simply eulogy, right? Oh, it's just kind of like over-glorifying. You know, this is one of the offenses to the holy name, right? To consider the glories of the holy name to be exaggeration. That you think, you know, Krishna is just kind of being praised, you know, and they're just kind of taking things a little too extreme. All right, and then the glorification of God, you know, you can't trust too much, you can't have too much faith, right? When the shastras are sort of like, you know, calling for you to complete and total surrender to the Supreme Lord, you know, they're just kind of exaggerating a bit, you know, and the glory is associated with surrender. You can't have that much faith, okay? So let's take a look at text 4. Maya titam idam sarvam jagad avyakta murtina matsthani sarva bhutani dachaham teshvavastataha. By me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. So in this particular section, Krishna is discussing his Aishvarya Gyan, essentially how he maintains the material universe, you see. So he begins describing himself by kind of talking about the qualification to understand himself, right? You have to have you have to have Shraddha, and from Prabhupada's purport we can understand, you know, it's a gradual development, but you have to come to the level where you're fixed at least, yeah? That's the Madhyamadikari he's displaying characteristics of Nishta. You know, he's moving through Anartanaviti or has moved through. He's developing that quality of rigidness, fixture in devotional service. Not that all these different stages, you know, you move from one stage to the other and you like somehow wake up one day and all of a sudden you're in, you know, Anartanaviti or something. Rather, the stages are sort of mentioning certain things which become prominent, you know. So there may be nishta to a smaller degree in people who are in Anartanaviti or in Sadhusanga, right? But once you get to that stage, then that becomes a very prominent part of your practice. Or like, for example, you know, from the very beginning you're practicing Anartanaviti. But during the stage of Anartanaviti, that's a very prominent part of your practice, struggling through and overcoming your various weaknesses, yeah? So anyway, you have to have this firm faith, and then also you have to be non-envious, right? There has to be that right attitude of surrender. So those two things, you're going to need those. So Krishna's kind of telling us, in order to understand me, you have to have these things, yeah? And now here he's going to start talking about himself, okay? He kind of got that out of the way, and now he's mentioning how he relates to the material energy, essentially that he's the creator, maintainer, and destroyer. He's the Alpha and Omega, right? That was the beginning and end of the Greek alphabet. It means like, you know, the beginning and end, yeah? So he is the Jagad Avyaktamurtina. So he's manifested within the universe, and by him everything is maintained. Matstani sarvabhutani nahatam nachaham teshvavastitaha. And Krishna likes to tell us this kind of contradiction about himself. And it's meant to inspire within us a certain sense of Aishvarya or awe and reverence, that he is essentially connected to the world but not connected to the world. Okay? He even says later, behold my mystic opulence, right? So the material universe is in essence, he pervades it everywhere. He's actually there as the supersoul within all things. And everything is, you know, as we heard in the seventh chapter, it's all on him like pearls are strung in a thread. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Sutre manigana iva. So the you know, it's a very beautiful thing. So he's saturating the entire universe, and it's completely floating within his glories, and yet he's also not in it. Boom, you know, abracadabra, right? This is magic, you know, this is he's the Yogeshvar. This is his supreme mystic opulence that he's somehow or other totally separate from the universe as well. Yeah? You say not a blade of grass moves without the will of God. That's true, but it's also going on by the laws of karma. You know, he's also detached. He's not directly going and trying to blow the grass, you know. Right? He has demigods do all that. He's totally separate. He's there enjoying in Vrindavan, right? Prabhupada says here, let's take a look at about halfway through the first paragraph, a little bit further. As we have discussed in the seventh chapter, the entire material cosmic manifestation is only a combination of his two different energies, the superior spiritual energy and the inferior material energy. So these are two very important verses, 7.4 and 7.5, right? Aparyamitastanyam prakriti vidime varam. So Krishna has his superior energy, the jiva, yayedam dharayate jagat, which the whole material universe is being maintained by the presence of the jiva. And then there's the bina prakritan ashtadha, the eightfold, you know, elements, including the subtle body. Okay? You all right? I've seen devotees get bored and tired, but when they're so tired where the pens are rolling out of their hands onto the ground, that's pretty... So, yes. So let's continue. It says just... Overwhelmed. So just as the sunshine is spread all over the universe, the energy of the Lord is spread all over the creation, and everything is resting in that energy. So Prabhupada's giving us an idea here that, you know, the sunshine is spread all over the universe, and everything's resting within the energy, but at the same time, the sunshine is different from the energy. Or you may say the sky. That's the one Krishna is going to mention coming up. that you have the sky, you have wind blowing within the sky, right? It's blowing all the clouds and everything. You have the kind of the movement of air within three-dimensional space. And so Krishna is like the three-dimensional space, and the air is like the material energy. Right? Krishna provides the background of existence, but he's untouched by it. But simultaneously, he pervades it all, just as three-dimensional space or ether or akash, it pervades the sky, which is moving. Does that make sense? So there's a simultaneous oneness and difference that's there, achintya bheda bheda tattva, right? That Krishna is simultaneously one and different from his creation. Okay? Yet one should not conclude that because he is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such an argument, the Lord says, I am everywhere and everything is in me, but still I am aloof. Okay, so it's not that, you know, Krishna somehow, you know, like something from Star Trek, you know, he's like a voiceless cloud of, what do you call it? Nebula or something, you know, the Star Trek Enterprise comes up to this nebula in outer space and it's like, you know, hello, you know, I am God. It's some kind of like, you know, vaporous energy and they have to shoot blasters at it or something, right? So, you know, it's not, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to sort of like turn God away from a person into just sort of like an energy, especially when we think of him in relationship to the world, right? We philosophize God and sort of extract him into like an energy field or something like that, some voice out in space, you know. And he somehow loses his personhood because he's pervading nature. You know, he can't be a person and pervade nature, right? He's got to lose his humanity to become omnipotent, you know? This is because we think in terms of ourselves, right? Like if somehow the only way I could understand reality and omnipotent level is if I somehow, like, you know, became one with the universe and lost my own existence. Or what's that movie, 2001? Space Oddity, right? Or Odyssey, sorry. 2001 Space Odyssey. And at the very end, like, he somehow, you know, raises to a higher level of consciousness and he's seen as like an embryo floating in front of the earth, you know? This kind of concept, you know, like if a human being rises beyond human consciousness, his personhood is distorted, you know, by time and space. He becomes some kind of new entity. So, you know, we have this, yeah, we see reality from our own limitation, you know. You can't be a person and be omnipotent. You can't be a person and understand reality, right? So Krishna is not that kind of person. He's not limited like that. He can have his own personhood just as we have. And at the same time, be omnipotent and conscious of everything, and omnipresent as well. Okay? Okay. Prabhupada gives us an example to understand this. We won't necessarily read this due to lack of time, but he basically mentions here, like, the king, you know, there's the king, he has all these government departments which are running under his power, under his energy. Yet he's not there in every single department telling everyone what to do. Right? Like the king, it's kind of like, you know, it's not that Krishna has to really watch and make sure that everything runs. Just by his power, just by his presence, then everything is running. Just like the king or the head of a company, like the manager, he's not even there, you know, like you have a factory or something like that. How many times does he actually visit the factory? You know, he may even have his own office there and stuff, right? He doesn't even go there. You know, maybe he's got like 10 other factories, you know. He's on his yacht, you know. He's off of the coast of Spain or something, right? He doesn't care. I mean, he calls every once in a while, you know. He gets an update, you know, through email from his managers, you know. He doesn't even talk to him on the phone, right, unless there's a problem. But otherwise, he's just, everything's going on. And everyone does their job because they know the managers, you know, ultimately that the head of the company's there, right? And so it's the same thing with Krishna. You know, all the demigods, they all know that Krishna's there, and therefore they conduct material existence. And he's not, you know, he's on his yacht in Vrindavan, right? So let's continue here in text 5. Nachamatstani bhutani pasyo pasyame yogam aishvaram bhuta brinnacha bhutesto mamatma bhuta bhavanaha. And yet everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. Pashyame yogam aishvaram, right? Just look at me, right? He's saying, just look, just see my yogam aishvaram, the great glorious power of my mystic potency. Yeah, this is God's mystic potency. is very powerful. You can see in the whole bewildering of Lord Brahma, right? Even Lord Brahma, the creator god of this universe, is bewildered by Krishna. He can't understand. It's beyond his capacity to understand the power of Krishna, power of God. Yeah? So he's Bhuta Brin, Chana Bhutashto. So he's the maintainer of everyone, right? The whole cosmic manifestation, but he's not within them. He's not within it. So he's beyond it. Prabhupada says here, the Lord says that everything is resting on him, matstani sarva bhutani. This should not be misunderstood. The Lord is not directly concerned with the maintenance and sustenance of this material manifestation. Sometimes we see a picture of Atlas holding the globe on his shoulders. He seems to be very tired, holding this great earthly planet. Such an image should not be entertained in connection with Krishna upholding this created universe. He says that although everything is resting in him, he is aloof. So he doesn't feel any weight whatsoever. It's all going on by his power, but he doesn't even notice. There's no effort on his part. It's just by his desire, yeah? Just by his wanting it to happen. That's all that he's, you know, he doesn't even have to do anything. All he does is just will it, and it's done, yeah? So the planetary systems are floating in space, and this space is the energy of the Supreme Lord, but he's different from space. He is different and differently situated. Therefore, the Lord says, although they are situated on my inconceivable energy, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am aloof from them. This is the inconceivable opulence of the Lord. All right. Let's look at text 6. Here's the verse I quoted. Itakasho stato nityam vayu sarvatrago mahan titasarvani bhutani matstanityupadharaya. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing ever rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. So Prabhupada here, it says here, for the ordinary person, it is almost inconceivable how the huge material creation is resting in him, meaning Krishna. But the Lord is giving an example which may help us to understand. The sky may be the biggest manifestation we can conceive. And in that sky, the wind or air is the biggest manifestation in the cosmic world. The movement of the air influences the movement of everything. But although the wind is great, it is still situated within the sky. The wind is not beyond the sky. Similarly, all the wonderful cosmic manifestations are existing by the supreme will of God, and all of them are subordinate to that supreme will. As we generally say, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, everything is moving under his will. By his will, everything is being created, everything is being maintained, and everything is being annihilated. Still, he is aloof from everything, as the sky is always aloof from the activities of the wind. So we already kind of explained that analogy. So he's aloof, he's not moving, you know, just like the sky is not moving when the wind is blowing in it, or the space, three-dimensional space. And at the same time, he does nothing. It's just by his will that the clouds are blowing, right? You can imagine if it was three-dimensional space, it's not moving, and yet if the space willed it, then all the air would move inside of it. Does that make sense? Kind of. I'm trying to kind of extend that analogy. But it doesn't really work. But anyway, the idea being that Krishna really doesn't have to do anything. He's not really doing anything. It's just going on by his presence, by his power alone. Okay? And Prabhupada mentions here, you know, the sun is moving by his power. Yach chakshudesa savita. Yasya gyaya brahmati kala chakra. Right? Sambritta kala chakra. So it's by his gyaya, the agyaya, the order of the Lord, that the sun is actually moving throughout the universe. And the sun is really the center of all life and power within the universe itself. The Raja Samasta, the king of all planets, right? Let's take a look at another one. Sarva Bhutani Kaunteya Prakritin Yanti Mamakam Kalpakshaya Punastani Kalpadao Visrajamyaham. O son of Kunti, at the end of the millennium, all material manifestations enter into my nature. At the beginning of another millennium, by my potency, I create them again. And let's take a look at the next one, text 8. Prakritam svam avastabhya visrajami puna punaha puttagdhamam imam kritsdam avasham prakritet vashat. The whole cosmic manifestation is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated at the end. So you'll see these two verses are really discussing creation and destruction. Yeah? That you have Krishna's first, he's been described as the maintainer. Bhutta Brin Nacha Bhuttasto, he's the Bhutta Brin. Everything is resting on him. He's providing for everything. Prabhupada mentions in the purport to text 8, this Bahusham, although I am one, I become many, right? that Krishna, he essentially expands himself into the material energy, and then nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam, right? This eko bahu, what is it? Vidadhati kaman? I can't remember the exact Sanskrit. Eko yo vibhati something. Vidadhati kaman. So the relationship between the two is that the one is always satisfying the desires of the many. Right? Krishna is essentially, he's maintaining everything and satisfying everyone's desires, and therefore he's the supreme maintainer, and yet he's also detached. Now in these two verses it explains how Krishna is also the source and the end, you know, with of destruction of the universe. The universe also ultimately expands from him and also contracts into him. Okay? All right. Let's just look at the second paragraph here, because we're almost out of time. We've got just like 5 minutes. But Prabhupada says here in the second paragraph to text 8, now as far as the living entities are concerned, they are impregnated into this material nature, and as a result of their past deeds, they take different positions. Thus the activities of the material world begin. The activities of the different species of living beings are begun from the very moment of their creation. It is not that all is evolved. The different species of life are created immediately along with the universe. Okay, so the idea that, you know, every one species evolves from the other, that's not according to the Vedic system. Rather, the Vedic idea is that the entire creation comes into existence at once. Everything, you know, is already there. And the reasoning is because the living entities essentially have their karma from their previous existence. Like, they already have their place within the previous creation, and they enter into the creation itself, you know, simultaneously, and the whole universe is created, right? And they kind of pick up where they left off. So it's kind of like the universe kind of begins where it ended before. Okay? All right. Let's take a look at text 9, and that will be our last verse for today. And then text 10 is a very famous verse, right? So, text 9. Nachamam tani karmani nibhadnanti dhananjaya udasanavad asanam asaptam te shukarmasu. O dhananjaya, all this work cannot bind me. I am ever detached from all these material activities, seated as though neutral. So, nachamam tani karmani nibhadnanti dhananjaya. So, Krishna is not bound by material nature, right? All these different activities, they're not connected to him. He has no karma. Krishna does not get karma, nor does he, because he's totally detached. Udasanavad, right? Asinam, asaktam tishu kanmasu. So he's essentially, what he's saying here is, I'm totally detached from material nature, therefore I don't get any karma. Right? And the devotees should be this way too. You know, udasanavad. Asinam, you have to be kind of like situated in an udasanavad, like you have to be totally detached from nature itself, and then you're not bound by karma. So that's why Krishna doesn't get karma. It's not because he's God and therefore he's beyond the law, which, you know, that's also a valid way of looking at it. You know, he doesn't have to get karma because he's the creator of karma. But really what Krishna says here is, I don't get karma because I'm detached, right? He's actually a yogi, you know? Krishna, even though God is the enjoyer of everything, but when it comes to material nature, he has no desire to enjoy it. He's the most detached person. You think about that. Right? Krishna is the most detached. He's the most detached yogi. Renunciation. Right? He has that opulence of renunciation in full. So you may look at, you know, okay, you look at what's a renounced person. You have sannyasis and gurus and, you know, babas and yogis, you know, who are stumbling through the Himalayas, not even aware whether they're wearing a kopan or not, whether they're clothed or not. You know, wow, they're so renounced. And then you have Krishna dancing with gopis and, you know, taking prasad on the lap of Mother Yashoda. Who's more renounced? Well, actually, Krishna is actually the more renounced one. Isn't that far out? Like, he's actually completely detached. He's the greatest of yogis, even though he's dancing and, you know, playing in the forest and all this stuff. So that's Krishna, right? Prabhupada says here, one should not think in this connection that the Supreme Personality of Godhead has no engagement. In his spiritual world, he is always engaged. In the Brahma Samhita 5.6, it is stated, Atmaramasya tasyasti prakritya na samagamaha. He is always involved in his eternal, blissful spiritual activities, but he has nothing to do with these material activities. You see, so he does, you know, he's enjoying, he's Atmaram, you know, he's enjoying his own self, right? He's playing with his own potencies in the spiritual world. That's what Krishna enjoys. Krishna enjoys with his own self, interacting with himself in the form of different expansions and shaktis. and us, right? But he enjoys loving relationships on the spiritual platform. He has no attachment to anything material. There's nothing material that's attractive to him, right? Not the physical bodies of others, not food or anything. Anything we offer him, that's not what he's interested in, right? Bhakti-pahatitam. He's interested only in the bhakti, okay? Material activities are being carried on by his different potencies. The Lord is always neutral in the material activities of the created world. This neutrality is mentioned here with the word udasanavat. Although he has control over every minute detail of material activities, he's sitting as if neutral. The example can be given of a high court judge sitting on his bench. By his order, so many things are happening. Someone is being hanged. Someone is being put into jail. Someone is awarded a huge amount of wealth, but still he is neutral. He has nothing to do with all the gain and loss. Similarly, the Lord is always neutral, although he has his hand in every sphere of activity. You see, so everything is going on by the law of karma. But just as the judge is neutral, he's not personally invested. He says somebody, you know, you do this, you do that, you do this. This one goes here. He's awarded, he's punished, and yet there's no personal involvement. He's just kind of inner. He's just being he or she is just being a representative of the law. It's the law which is punishing this person, not me, right? It's the law which is awarded. You know, like if a person goes to a judge and says, "Thank you so much," oh, you know, like in the courtroom. Oh, thank you so much. The judge should be neutral. He says, it's not me, it's the law, right? It's not me. And similarly, if the person points at the judge and says, "No, damn you, how could you do this? You know, I'll get you one day, I'll get you," right? As they drag him out, you know, it's not me, it's the law, right? I'm just exacting, you know, I'm just sort of in a very detached way giving you your results under the law. And so similarly, Krishna, he just awards people by his shakti. He gives power for the law of karma to function. He's not responsible for what happens to you within that sphere of karma. You create that yourself, right? You interacting with the world 100%, it's on you. You know, you're making choices and then experiencing the result of those choices. And therefore people say, you know, if there's a God, how can bad things happen to bad good people, right? But the reality is that it's the law of karma. You know, and whatever is happening in this world, it's self-contained. He doesn't interfere. He may interfere if someone's trying to surrender to him, right? If you're trying to surrender to him, then he's no longer udasanavat. Otherwise, he with just the material, you know, the person, the living entity conditioned by and absorbed in material energy, he's udasanavat. He doesn't interfere. You're on your own path, and he doesn't like it. He loves you as a soul, but he's not going to interfere with your free will. He's going to allow you a field of activity in which you can do whatever you like. He doesn't interfere. He doesn't try to control you. Doesn't tell you what to do. But you also have to experience the reactions of your activities. And he gives his power to make all of that happen. But he's detached. He's watching from a distance, neutral. Whereas with the devotee, as soon as someone tries to surrender to him or serve him, then he gives up that neutrality and he tries to help you. You can see in the lives of people, like I even experienced that before I was a devotee. It's like the minute you pray to God, when you're like a total materialist, the minute you pray to God, it's almost like he's like, dun da da da, here I am. You know, like miraculous things happen. It's very far out, you know. Like you can just like, if you're just lost in material existence with no knowledge, it's amazing. Like you can, you know, he's neutral to you, but he's like waiting for any opportunity. And as soon as you express even the slightest amount of religious inclination or whatever, he'll just come through like, you know, like a storm, you know, like, you know, yes, God is real. Look at this. Here's a miracle right for you. You know, it happens all the time. God, you know, puts these powerful miracles into people's lives because he's giving up his neutrality. That's what he's doing. He's just waiting for any moment to give up his neutrality and step in there and kind of show you, yes, surrender to me. But generally, when it comes to your material existence, he's neutral. Okay? Therefore, you can't really blame God for your, you know, for the things that happen in the world because it's a product of the law of karma. It's basically what you had coming from your previous actions. And that's very difficult. And therefore, people generally tend to point fingers at others, right? Especially in Kali Yuga. It's all about, you know, you did this and you did that and you did this and you did that. You know, and it's never looking at oneself and accepting this is my karma. And therefore people ultimately they say to God, you did this. You know, you're the one. You stub your toe. Oh, how could you do this? Oh, I served you so. You know, like you split, you know, you put, what do you call it? You stub your toe. Oh,
I served you for so long. How can you do this?
But you have to, again, that's the neophyte, right? Your Shraddha is hurt by that. But the person who has the visual, the understanding of scripture, they're able to stop instead of pointing fingers and start accepting responsibility for one's own karma. Okay? Thank you very much. All glories, Prabhupada.